A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been stocking up on some preparedness gear recently. Picked up a Neatcore headlamp and compact torch, and then fell down the rabbit hole of their professional lineup. He discovered lights that cost over $500 and can throw a beam 2 kilometers, and he's wondering who's actually buying these things. His theory is search and rescue and law enforcement teams. And what caught his attention is how these aren't just one super bright flashlight. They're complementary systems. You've got saber-like, ultra-fine beam throwers, wide-sweep beacons, and headlamps, all designed to work together.
The backpack part is what gets me every time. You hold a light like the Neatcore TM39, it's about the size of a relay baton, maybe a bit thicker, and you point it at a mountainside a mile away, and it just paints a visible spot on it. Right. And the thing that jumps out immediately is he's already spotted what most people miss. These aren't just brighter flashlights. They're tools built around completely different optical philosophies. A thrower and a floodlight are as different as a telescope and a lampshade. They just happen to both use LEDs.
The telescope and the lampshade. That's almost the episode right there.
But the really interesting part is how they work together in the field, and the physics that makes a pocketable device visible from 3 kilometers up. Let's start with the most extreme case, the lights that can reach out and touch something 2 kilometers away. How does that even work?
Because my kitchen drawer flashlight, which I thought was perfectly adequate, can maybe reach the end of the hallway with some dignity.
That's the first misconception worth busting. More lumens does not equal more throw. Lumens is total light output, how many photons are leaving the front of the light in all directions. Throw is about candela, the intensity of the beam in one specific direction. You can have a 4,000 lumen floodlight that lights up your entire backyard beautifully, and a 500 lumen LEP light that outthrows it by a factor of 3.
Who actually buys these lights, and how do they use them? Let's start by breaking down the 3 main types of professional torches.
So professional lighting breaks into 3 archetypes. First, you've got throwers. These are the saber-like beams, extremely narrow, designed to put as much light as possible onto a single distant point. Think of the TM39, and that's where the optical engineering gets fascinating. To get extreme throw, you need 2 things: a very small, very intense light source, and a very large, very precisely shaped reflector or optic to focus it. The smaller the LED, the easier it is to focus into a tight beam. The luminous SBT90.2 LED, which is in a lot of these extreme throwers, produces 4,500 lumens from a single die that's only 4 square millimeters. That's about the size of a grain of rice, putting out more light than a car headlight.
A grain of rice screaming with the fury of a small sun.
That's not even an exaggeration. The surface brightness of these LEDs is higher than the surface of the sun. Not total output, the sun wins that one comfortably, but per square millimeter, these emitters are more intense. And because the source is so tiny, you can put it at the focal point of a deep parabolic reflector, and the light comes out in a nearly parallel beam. The Asabeam K75 uses a 94mm reflector, that's almost 4 inches across, to focus 2,600 lumens into a beam that measures 1.2 million candela.
The professional approach isn't find the one perfect light, it's carry the right lights for the right jobs and switch between them.
Switching is faster than fiddling with modes on a single light anyway. If you're moving from scanning a distant tree line to treating a patient at your feet, you don't want to cycle through 5 brightness levels and a zoom mechanism. Here's the part that messes with your intuition. The beam isn't just reaching that far. It's reaching that far with enough intensity that you can actually see detail.
Which brings us to the thrower, the most impressive one from a specs perspective. How do you actually build a light that can reach 2 kilometers?
At 1500 meters, the K75 is still putting moonlight level illumination on a person. At half that distance, it's dramatically brighter. Candela measures intensity in a specific direction. Throw distance is entirely about candela. A 500 lumen light with a tight enough beam can outthrow a 2000 lumen light with a wide beam. It sorta does, and that's the hidden bottleneck nobody talks about. Thermal management. These lights at max output are drawing 50 to 80 watts. That's more power than an old incandescent desk lamp.
Lumens are the horsepower. Candela is the torque.
That's actually a really good analogy. Horsepower tells you the engine's total output, but torque tells you how much force is actually reaching the wheels in a useful direction. Candela is what reaches the target. That's exactly the difference between a consumer light and a professional one. A $30 Amazon flashlight will give you a burst of brightness and then steadily dim as the battery drains and the heat builds up. It's unregulated, so the output curve looks like a ski slope. A professional light has a regulated driver that maintains constant output until the battery can't sustain it, and then it steps down in a controlled way.
Every additional kilometer of throw costs you exponentially more candela. It's not a linear game.
With that fan running, it can sustain 2,000 lumens for over 30 minutes without throttling. It's wide and deep, shaped like a satellite dish, because the size of the reflector directly determines how much of the LED's light you can capture and focus. A larger reflector collects more photons and collimates them into a tighter beam.
Collimation being the process of making all the light rays parallel.
But for a search and rescue team scanning a canyon at night, 30 minutes of sustained 2,000 lumen output is the difference between spotting a lost hiker and flying blind. And the fan is sealed. The whole thing is still IP68 rated, so you can drop it in water and it keeps running.
Okay, so we've got the physics of throw. Tiny, intense LED, big, deep reflector, active cooling so it doesn't melt itself. But what about the other end of the spectrum? The beacons and floodlights Daniel was asking about?
That's where the optical philosophy completely flips. A thrower is designed to put as many photons as possible into a beam that's fractions of a degree wide. A floodlight or beacon is designed to spread light evenly across 60, 90, 120 degrees. The key metric there isn't candela, it's beam angle and beam pattern quality. You want smooth, even illumination with no hot spots or rings.
Because you're not trying to spot a person 2 kilometers away. You're trying to see everything within 20 meters of you.
And for search and rescue, this is actually the more important light most of the time. The thrower identifies the target area. You scan the opposite ridgeline. You spot a reflection that might be a jacket or a watch. But then you have to actually get there.
That's exactly why the professionals carry multiple systems. Let's put some numbers on this. Compare the TM39 to something like the Nightcore P12, a solid consumer light.
The P12 is rated at about 10,000 candela and a 200 meter throw. That's perfectly good for walking your dog or finding something in the attic. The TM39 is 1.2 million candela and 2.2 kilometers. That's where headlamps become essential. A good SAR headlamp like the Nightcore HC65 has a 100 degree flood beam for close-up work, plus a secondary throw LED for when you need to look ahead.
The TM39 isn't even the top of the line anymore. There's the Aspeam X75, pushing 2.5 kilometers.
The ceiling keeps moving, but the physics doesn't. You still need a large reflector, a high-intensity LED, and a lot of power. The TM39 runs on 4 18650 cells, which are each about the size of a thumb. The flood beam on these is genuinely impressive. The HC65's flood mode uses a honeycomb TIR optic, total internal reflection, that creates this perfectly even wall of light. No center hotspot, no dim edges. It's like turning on the overhead lights in a room, except the room is a forest and the ceiling is tree canopy.
A portable ceiling. Another product category that doesn't exist.
Give it time. But here's where it gets really interesting, how teams actually coordinate these different lights in the field. A typical 4-person SAR team carries 8 to 12 lights total, at least 2 dedicated throwers, 4 to 6 headlamps, and then usually 1 or 2 beacon or signal lights. And they're not just carrying spares, each light has a specific role in the search pattern. The beam is tight enough that they can paint individual features. That cluster of pines, that rock outcropping, and look for anything that doesn't belong. A flash of color from a jacket. A glint from a water bottle. Let's say a hiker is reported missing in a forested canyon area. The team arrives at the trailhead around 10 p.m. The first thing they do is set up a command point and start scanning.
The thrower is the team's long-range eye, and the headlamps are their feet. two completely separate visual tasks happening simultaneously.
A watch face, a jacket zipper, a phone screen. Even a tiny reflection at that distance will catch the beam. There's no middle ground with optics.
The headlamp in this scenario, something like the Nightcore HC-35.
Meanwhile, two other team members are suiting up with flood headlamps and preparing to descend. The fourth person stays at the command point with a beacon light, something like the Nightcore NU-05, which is the size of a car key fob, but can be seen from 5 kilometers away at night.
The size of a car key fob, visible from 5 kilometers. That's absurd.
It's a 1,000-lumen strobe with a wide-angle optic designed specifically for 360-degree visibility. It's not trying to throw a beam, it's trying to be seen from any direction.
Let's shift to the other side of the equation. How do you design a light that's meant to be seen from kilometers away, or from an aircraft, rather than to see by?
If there's a helicopter involved, the crew can spot that strobe from 5 kilometers out, especially if they're using night vision goggles. With a beacon, you need to be visible from a wide range of angles, ideally 360 degrees, and you need to stand out against visual clutter. A flashlight in strobe mode is terrible for signaling because the beam is too narrow. If you're not pointing it directly at the helicopter, they won't see it.
The stakes are different too. A beacon isn't about finding something. It's about being found.
Dedicated beacon lights solve this with optics that spread the light in a dome pattern. A helicopter is inbound, but the terrain is forested, there are no landmarks visible from the air, and the pilot is looking down at a dark patchwork of trees and rock. The searchers are using their flood headlamps to illuminate the immediate area, maybe 10 to 20 meters in front of them. They're looking for footprints, broken branches, discarded items.
A white flashlight beam isn't going to cut it.
If one of them needs to look further ahead, maybe they hear something, or they want to scan a distant feature. They switch to the secondary throw LED on their headlamp. And all the while, the thrower operator up top is providing overwatch. If they spot something, they radio down. Check your 11 o'clock, about 800 meters. There's something reflective near the large pine.
The team is functioning as a distributed lighting system.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. It's not a bunch of people with flashlights. It's a coordinated optical network where each light serves a different function. Long-range detection, close-range search, and position marking. And in law enforcement tactical situations, this gets even more structured. A SWAT team breaching a building, the point man has a weapon-mounted light with a tight beam for identifying threats at distance. The rear man has a floodlight on their vest for illuminating the whole room once they're inside. Someone outside has a beacon on the roof to mark the entry point for air support.
Every light has a job. Nobody's carrying a general purpose anything.
That's the thing that Daniel noticed just from looking at Nightcore's product lineup. The professional lights aren't just brighter versions of consumer lights. They're purpose-built for specific operational roles. And the companies know this. They market them as systems. Nightcore's P-Series is specifically for tactical and law enforcement use, with features like instant strobe access and rotary ring controls that let you smoothly transition from flood to throw by physically moving the LED forward and backward in the reflector.
Wait, the LED physically moves inside the light.
In the Nightcore SRT-7i, yes. You turn a ring on the body of the light, and it shifts the LED's position relative to the reflector. All the way forward gives you a tight throw beam. All the way back gives you a wide flood. And you get everything in between. It's a single light solution for teams that can't carry multiple specialized lights. A patrol officer, for instance, who might need to search a vehicle one moment and illuminate a distant alley the next.
That's clever engineering. Instead of carrying a thrower and a flood, you carry one light that can be either.
The trade-off is, it's not as good at either extreme as a dedicated light. The reflector geometry is a compromise. But for a lot of professional users, the versatility outweighs the performance hit. And that's the kind of trade-off that only makes sense when you understand the operational context.
Which brings us to the environmental factors. Daniel mentioned altitude. How do these lights perform when you're 3,000 meters up a mountain and it's 20 below?
This is where things get complicated. At high altitude, the air is thinner and cleaner, so beams actually travel further with less scatter. That's a win for throwers. But the cold is brutal on batteries. A standard 21700 lithium-ion cell loses 40 to 50% of its capacity at minus 20 Celsius. and if you're drawing high current, which these lights do at max output, the voltage sag can cause the light to step down or shut off entirely.
Your 2-kilometer thrower becomes a 1-kilometer thrower with half the runtime, purely because of the cold.
SAR teams operating in those conditions have protocols for this. They keep spare batteries in inner pockets close to body heat. Some use low-temperature rated cells. The Samsung 40T is rated for continuous discharge down to minus 10 Celsius, which is better than most. And some professional lights have built-in battery heaters or use proprietary battery packs with thermal management. But it's a real limitation. The terrain was too steep for a ground carry, so they called in a helicopter. The team marked their position with red beacons, SRT-7 type lights, and the pilot reported picking them up from about 800 meters out through light fog. Worse than useless, it's actively counterproductive. A tight beam in fog creates massive backscatter. All those photons hit water droplets right in front of you and bounce back into your eyes. It's like turning on your high beams in a snowstorm. You see less than you would with low beams. For fog and heavy snow, you want a floodlight with a warm color temperature around 3000 Kelvin.
40% is enormous. In a hypothermia case, that's the whole game.
It's the difference between finding someone conscious and finding someone who's been unconscious for an hour. And that's why agencies spend $500 on a flashlight. It's not gear enthusiasm. And this is another place where professional lights differentiate themselves. Some of them offer warm white emitter options specifically for this reason. The Nightcore HC65 comes in a warm white version.
The complementarity goes beyond just thrower plus beacon. What does a typical SAR team member's lighting kit actually look like?
It varies by role, but a common loadout would be a thrower on a shoulder strap or in a chest rig for long-range search, a headlamp for hands, free close work and navigation, a beacon, often clipped to the back of a pack or helmet, for position marking, and sometimes a dedicated floodlight for scene illumination if they're setting up a staging area or treating a patient. 4 lights, 4 distinct jobs.
A fifth if you count the backup.
A 1,000-lumen strobe under the same conditions is visible from over 10 kilometers. But during the day, you're competing with ambient light. A white strobe against a bright sky is hard to see.
What's the solution?
Colored filters and different wavelengths. Red and green strobes cut through better during the day because they contrast against blue sky and green foliage. And for operations involving aircraft, the real game changer is infrared strobes. These are invisible to the naked eye, but extremely bright under night vision goggles. A helicopter crew wearing NVGs can spot an IR strobe from much further than a visible one, because there's essentially zero ambient IR competition at night.
The beacon that's invisible to you is screamingly obvious to the people who need to see it.
That's also useful for tactical situations where you don't want to give away your position to someone who might be looking. Law enforcement teams use IR beacons extensively. The helicopter knows exactly where the ground team is, but nobody on the ground without night vision can see the signal.
Let's talk about the LEP lights you mentioned earlier. Laser-excited phosphor. That sounds like science fiction.
It's wild technology. Instead of an LED, you have a blue laser diode shining onto a phosphor-coated substrate. The laser excites the phosphor, which emits a broad-spectrum white light. But because the source is a laser, the beam divergence is incredibly low, under 1 degree. The Phoenix TK30 is an LEP light that produces 500 lumens but throws 1500 meters.
The takeaway isn't go buy a $500 flashlight. It's think about your lighting as a system, not a single purchase.
Pay attention to the specs that actually matter. For throw, look at candela, not lumens. For flood, lumens are more relevant, but also look at beam angle. 1,000 lumens in a tight beam is useless for close work. The beam from an LEP light is saber-like. There's almost no spill. It's a tight, clean cylinder of light. Great for pointing at things a kilometer away. Completely useless for walking because you can't see your feet.
The world's most expensive laser pointer.
But LEP technology is maturing fast. The Azabeam W50, which came out in 2025, does 2.5 kilometers of throw from a 500 lumen LEP source, and the costs are coming down. 5 years ago, an LEP light was a $1,000 curiosity. Now you can get one for under $300.
Which raises the question, where does this go next? If we're already at pocketable lights that can reach 2.5 kilometers, what's the ceiling?
The limit right now is in optics. It's battery energy density. We can build optics that throw further. We can build more efficient LEDs and LEP sources. But you still need to power the thing, and lithium ion cells are approaching their theoretical limits. A single 26800 cell holds about 25 watt hours. An extreme thrower at turbo draws 50 to 80 watts.
The Swiss Army knife fallacy.
And look, Swiss Army knives are great for opening packages and tightening the occasional screw. But if you need to baton firewood, you want a fixed blade knife. If you need to see a ridgeline at 2 kilometers, you want a thrower. Or in hybrid approaches. Some lights are starting to integrate supercapacitors for burst output, with the battery handling sustained lower output.
Let's talk about something that's been in the back of my mind through all of this. The miniaturization trajectory. The TM39 fits in a jacket pocket. 5 years ago, a 1,000,000 candela light was the size of a soda can and needed a shoulder strap. I'd imagine there's a convergence coming with other technologies too. Lights that do more than just produce light.
It's already starting. The Nightcore HC35 headlamp has a built-in power bank function. You can charge your phone from your headlamp. Some tactical lights now integrate with weapon systems, automatically adjusting beam pattern based on what the weapon is pointed at. The next step is lights that form mesh networks. Your headlamp talks to your teammate's headlamp, sharing position data and creating a distributed lighting grid that adjusts based on where everyone is looking.
A swarm of headlamps coordinating their beams. That's either brilliant or deeply unsettling.
For SAR, it's brilliant.
What does that mean for everyday carry, for personal safety?
That's where this is heading. It's not just a convenience, it's a capability that used to be reserved for professionals, and it's trickling down. The same way GPS went from military only to your phone, extreme throw and beacon technology are going from SAR teamed to your pocket.
The beacon side. Are we going to see consumer-grade lights with aviation visible signaling?
You're better off with two lights. A good headlamp for hands, free flood use, and a compact thrower for scanning distance. Total cost around $150 to $200. Imagine a light that pairs with your phone and transmits your GPS coordinates via coded light pulses, visible to a drone or a helicopter. That's not science fiction. The modulation technology exists. The Nightcore HC65 headlamp runs about $80. It's got that 100-degree flood beam with a secondary throw LED, USB, C rechargeable, IP68 rated.
The next time someone sees a $500 flashlight and thinks it's just for enthusiasts with more money than sense.
You could walk, work, search close up, and scan distance. It's about the engineering, the reliability, and the fact that in the moment it's needed, it cannot fail.
The fact that it fits in a backpack is genuinely remarkable. 1,000,000 candela from something you can hold in one hand. That's a triumph of optical engineering, thermal management, and battery technology all converging.
Clip it to your pack and forget about it until you need it. Much more effective than trying to use your flashlight strobe mode for signaling. The headlamp in your camping kit would have been military-grade hardware 30 years ago.
The professional stuff. The TM39s and SRT7s is pushing into territory that used to require vehicle-mounted equipment.
You only need to carry one type of spare and one charger. The moment you introduce a light with a proprietary battery pack, you're now carrying a separate charger and separate spares for that one device. In a preparedness context, that's a real liability. So the professionals will keep carrying multiple lights, and the informed consumers will too.
For someone building a preparedness kit, whether they're worried about geopolitical tensions or just want to be ready for a power outage, the advice is, think in systems. Look at candela, not lumens for throw. Don't try to find the one perfect light. And understand that the expensive professional gear is expensive for reasons that have nothing to do with marketing.
And buy quality cells. Samsung, LG, Molicel. Don't buy mystery brand cells from Amazon. A counterfeit lithium ion cell is a fire waiting to happen. It's just physics.
Speaking of things that have nothing to do with physics, and now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, astronomers observing from Cape Verde reported that certain transient lunar phenomena, brief flashes or color changes on the moon's surface, appeared to produce faint acoustic signatures when monitored with early resonant detection chambers. The effect was never replicated and remains unexplained.
Acoustic signatures from moon flashes.
Every component is specced for failure conditions, not just normal operation. A $30 light works fine on a camping trip. It fails when you're searching a collapsed building in the rain.
Which is, of course, when you need it most.
That's the cruel irony of preparedness gear. You don't know if it's good until you need it, and when you need it, it's too late to upgrade. So the professional stuff is expensive because it's engineered for the worst-case scenario.
That's probably for the best. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.